a base hit. It's a 1-0.
You'll never hit a bigger home run in your life.
Fly ball deep left center. Grissom
on the game over. World Series.
A World Series win. Game over. Series over.
As a little girl, Toni Stone was determined to play Major League Baseball, although in the end, she would come up a little short. Toni Stone would overcome both racism and sexism to become one of the greatest female players in baseball history. I'm Nina, and this is Deadball. Marcenia Lyle Stone, better known as Toni, was born July 17, 1921, in Bluefield, West Virginia, though she would spend much of her life in St. Paul, Minnesota. Toni's parents were originally from Alabama, but they migrated north for better opportunities and to escape Jim Crow laws in the South. Toni, who was nicknamed Tomboy, her father was a barber, and he opened a small shop in St. Paul in 1922. Life in Minnesota wasn't completely without hardship and discrimination. In nearby Duluth, Minnesota, three black men were lynched shortly before the Stone family moved to the area. It was on June 15, 1920, that three African-American circus workers, Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee, suspects in an assault case, were taken from jail and lynched by a white mob of thousands in Duluth. Rumors had circulated that six African-Americans raped and robbed a 19-year-old woman. A physician's examination of the victim subsequently found no physical evidence of rape. But that information wasn't enough to save Clayton, Jackson, and McGee. So this is the community where she grew up, and neighborhood kids nicknamed her Tomboy because she really proved herself as an athlete, particularly in baseball. Quote, "Baseball was like a drug," she told an interviewer in 1991. Quote, "Whenever summer would come around, the bats would start popping. I'd go crazy." Toni embraced the nickname Tomboy and would carry it with her the rest of her life. And while she was popular in the neighborhood, she also enjoyed spending time alone. She loved to read and did not miss an issue of the Chicago Defender, an African-American newspaper. She closely followed the box scores of the Negro Leagues, especially the exploits of her heroes, Satchel Paige, Cool Papa Bell, and of course, the great Josh Gibson. Tomboy kept up on the hometown team, the St. Paul Saints. They were the local minor league affiliate of the New York Giants. In addition, she always enjoyed watching barnstorming teams that visited St. Paul. Her favorite player was Babe Ruth, and she met him several times, and he was always nice to her. Tomboy's love for the game wasn't enough to convince her parents it was something a girl should be doing. Not only did it fly in the face of traditional gender conventions, but from a practical standpoint, there was no future in baseball, not for a black girl from Minnesota. In fact, her parents thought the idea of a little girl playing baseball was sinful. They overwhelmed her with guilt that at age 8 she prayed for forgiveness and even went so far as to confess her sin to a local priest. Rather than condemning her for playing a game she loved, the priest convinced her parents to allow her to play in a church league, which, until Tomboy arrived, had been boys only. Even though her parents agreed to let her play, they weren't going to encourage her with financial support, so she did odd jobs around the neighborhood in order to be able to buy a glove from Goodwill. Stone was on her own, in every possible way. And when she played, she was the only girl on the field, and although there was no well-worn path for her to walk, she still dreamed of being a professional athlete. Quote, "I didn't concern myself that there weren't any women in the game," she said of her younger days. Her parents encouraged her to take up ice skating, and she followed their wishes. She was a talented skater and even won a trophy as the best female skater in St. Paul. Even though she enjoyed skating, she never felt passionate about it. Her first and only love was baseball. In addition to playing on the Boys Church League, Tomboy also played girls softball. And she excelled at it, but she didn't enjoy softball because she found it too slow. She craved the excitement and pace of baseball. Her next step toward her dream of becoming a professional player came in the form of a minor league manager named Gabby Street. Now, Gabby Street was a good old boy from Huntsville, Alabama, and Street had a very up-and-down baseball career. Street was known as a good-glove, no-hit catcher. In fact, Gabby Street was playing in the Pacific Coast League when he was nearly killed in the San Francisco earthquake. Later, while with the Washington Senators, he would gain a degree of fame by catching a ball dropped from the top of the Washington Monument. It would take 13 tries, but he finally caught the last ball. And it was calculated that this ball was traveling at 282 miles an hour when Street snagged it. Street's other claim to fame was being a mentor and personal catcher of Hall of Famer Walter Johnson of the Washington Nationals. These accomplishments aside, Gabby Street had poor hitting skills and a drinking problem that plagued him most of his adult life. Gabby continued to play minor league baseball to keep himself fed and cover his bar tabs. And despite being an excellent defensive catcher, he couldn't hit, and by 1912, he was no longer playing baseball. In the late 1920s, Street took up coaching in the minor leagues. He really enjoyed working with younger players and teaching the finer points of the game. In 1929, Gabby Street was named to the St. Louis Cardinals coaching staff, where he continued in his new role, mentoring and guiding young players. When Cardinals manager Bill McKechnie resigned at the end of the 1929 season, Gabby Street was named the Cardinals' new manager. And this was the beginning of the Gas House Gang area in St. Louis. Gabby Street promptly led the Cardinals to consecutive National League pennants. In 1930, they won 92 games and finished 2 games in front of the Chicago Cubs. But in the 1930 World Series, they faced the defending world champion Philadelphia Athletics and lost in 6 games. In 1931, Street's Cardinals won 101 games and bested the Giants by 13 games. Then, in the 1931 series, the Cardinals defeated heavily favored Philadelphia Athletics in 7 games to win the world championship. Gabby Street was on top of the baseball world. However, the Cardinals faltered in 1932, and soon, Gabby Street was out of baseball once again. In 1935, Gabby Street was offered a position to manage the minor league team, the St. Paul Saints. It was around this time that Street met 15-year-old Tony Stone. In addition to managing the Saints, Gabby earned a little extra money serving as the director of a local baseball school for boys. At this point, Tomboy had been playing for the church league for 4 years, and she was frustrated because the coach would allow her to play, but he wouldn't invest any time in coaching her to help her be a better player. So Tony watched Gabby Street conduct his baseball classes from afar. She was always the first person to show up for instruction and the last to leave. Tony Stone would watch while he coached at a park near her house, and she moved closer and closer to the field, straining to hear his instructions. You see, her parents could not afford for her to take the classes, and even if they could afford it, girls were not permitted in the class. And if that wasn't bad enough, there is no way the school would have allowed a black girl to play with white students. It simply wasn't done. And if the school would have allowed it, Gabby Street would not. Because, you see, Gabby Street belonged to the Ku Klux Klan and had a well-documented history of racism throughout his career. But Tony showed up for instruction anyway, She would take notes and go through all the baseball drills by herself off to the side. She wanted to learn all she could, but knew that this program was off limits to her. One day, she worked up the nerve to approach him, and she asked to join his class. She wanted to study under him, and Street said no. So she came back a few days later and asked, and he said no again. After a few weeks of this, Gabby Street relented, quote, "I just couldn't get rid of her until I gave her a chance," he recalled. "Every time I chased her away, she would go around the corner and come back to plague me again." Tomboy's persistence won him over, and eventually Street let her join all the drills, telling her to get on the field and, quote, "show those boys up." But what Tomboy didn't know is that not only was Street's program intentionally all boys, it was intentionally all white. Now, Street's acceptance of Tomboy wasn't necessarily at odds with his racism. He could make an exception for one black girl who seemed obsessed with baseball without reevaluating his own racist attitudes towards all black people. And it was through Street's guidance that Tony began to blossom as a baseball player, and eventually Gabby became her mentor, and they would remain connected for the rest of his life. He would use his connections through baseball to find opportunities for his unlikely protege. In the late 1930s, armed with improved skills, Toni Stone was ready for the next step. She wanted to get more serious about baseball. The church league was fine, but she knew she could do better. She'd been working as a ball girl for a local pickup league, and the league's organizer recognized that she could do more than just shag fly balls. He also managed the Twin City Colored Giants and asked Stone if she would be interested in joining this team's youth traveling squad. The team traveled on the weekends, and 16-year-old Toni Stone was the only girl on the team. Toni then brought her talent to other barnstorming and independent teams, first the San Francisco Sea Lions, which she left after finding out she was being paid less than the male players, and then she moved on to the New Orleans Creoles. In 1949, Street was stricken with cancer, and Toni Stone was there for him. When Gabby Street died of heart failure in 1951, Toni Stone cried openly at his funeral. She was the only black person in attendance. Toni remained in New Orleans, playing for the Creoles until 1950, when she married a man who asked her to put her baseball ambitions on hold. She spent a year away from the game before she realized it was too much a part of who she was to push aside. Her marriage and her love of baseball were at odds, but Toni was determined to have them both. She got her way. The couple stayed married, and she returned to baseball when the Indianapolis Clowns came calling. Quote, "He would have stopped me if he could have," Stone said, "but he couldn't." Now, the Clowns are compared to the Harlem Globetrotters of the baseball world, so having a woman on the team attracted more fans. The Clowns had recently lost their star player, someone you may have heard of, a young shortstop named Henry Hank Aaron, who eventually made his way to the major leagues, a move many Negro League players made as the league gradually integrated. During the 50 games that Toni played for the Clowns, she maintained a .243 batting average, and one of her hits was off the legendary Satchel Paige. In April of 1953, at age 32, Toni Stone reported to the team and officially became the first woman to play in the Negro Leagues as a second baseman. And she wanted her abilities to be the main attraction, so when Clown's owner Sid Pollock suggested she wear a skirt instead of a uniform, she told him she'd quit first. Quote, "I wasn't going to wear no shorts," she told an interviewer. "This is professional baseball." Stone's playing thrust her into the spotlight, filling stands and newspaper columns as everyone became eager to see her in action. The black media was buzzing. Norfolk's Journal and Guide called her, quote, "a badly needed shot in the arm for the Negro Leagues." Praise of her abilities wasn't reserved for the sports pages or the black media, though. Nationally syndicated entertainment columnist Dorothy Kilgallen also praised her, saying, quote, She belts home runs as easily as most girls catch stitches in their knitting, and the sports boys are goggle-eyed. While Toni Stone was the first female player in the Negro Leagues, she was not met with open arms. Most of the male ball players shunned her and gave her a hard time because she was a woman. Interestingly enough, Toni was proud of the fact that the male players were out to get her. She would show off scars on her wrist and remember the time she'd been spiked by a runner trying to take out the woman standing on second base. And looking back across the decades, you may wonder just how good of a player was Toni Stone? We may never know. Unfortunately, records from the Negro League are not complete. It's not uncommon for conflicting information to surround Negro League players, making it hard to say with any certainty what her skill level was. Not only were records not well kept for the Negro Leagues, there was a disinformation problem with the league. They wanted her to be a big draw, so her stats and salary were often falsely inflated. They also presented her as several years younger than her actual age. Toni stayed with the Clowns until 1954, but by then she wasn't the only woman on the team. Two others, Mamie Johnson and Connie Morgan, had also been signed. With two new younger women players on a team that would only allow one woman in the lineup at a time, Toni knew that her time with the team was ending. She left the Clowns to join the Kansas City Monarchs, where she'd end her professional baseball career in 1955. And while Toni made history and opened doors, she was treated even worse by her teammates and the organization in Kansas City. Even though she was part of the team, Toni was not allowed in the locker room. If she was lucky, she would be allowed to change in the umpire's locker room. As the 50s came to a close, the Negro League was contracting and jobs were scarce. Many of her teammates felt that Toni was taking a job away from a male baseball player and potentially taking a job away from them. As a result, she was ostracized and isolated. She spent most of the game on the bench, sitting by teammates who resented and hated her. You see, by the mid-1950s, Major League Baseball was fully integrated, with the most talented black players like Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, and even Satchel Paige now in the major leagues. Negro League just wasn't a draw like it was 5 years earlier. Financially, teams of the Negro League were struggling, and they looked for inexpensive, gimmicky ways to attract fans to the ballpark. But the writing was on the wall. The league would not last much longer. Like the other great players in the Negro Leagues, Toni Stone played despite knowing she might never make it to the majors. They had to endure the injustice of not being able to compete. Many did cross over, but so many great black athletes never got the chance. Sadly, the times dictated that this was the way things were. The love of the game kept them going. Toni Stone really had to love baseball to do what she did. Toni Stone persevered. After the 1954 season, Toni moved to Oakland, California, where she worked as a nurse and cared for her sick husband. He died in 1987 at the age of 103. In 1985, Toni Stone was inducted into the Women's Sports Foundation's International Hall of Fame. In 1990, she was included in two exhibits at the Baseball Hall of Fame, one on women in baseball and another focused on Negro League baseball. In 1993, Stone was inducted into the Women's Sports Hall of Fame as well as the Sudafed International Women's Sports Hall of Fame. In 1990, Stone's hometown of St. Paul, Minnesota, declared March 6th Toni Stone Day. Toni Stone died on November 2, 1996, at a nursing home in Alameda, California. She was 75 years old. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Deadball, and thank you, Timmy, for allowing me the opportunity to host.